FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 10/23/18. Just a little more than 2 months to go till we conclude an amazing year, one that I wouldn't have believed possible a short time ago, but here we are, and rapidly approaching 2019. What are you doing about your investments? What about passive income? Do you have enough of it? No, that's a dumb question. You can never have too much passive income. Kind of like being too rich and too thin. Hey, as always, be a part of the show. Email me at kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, the person you're about to hear from has built a passive income portfolio for himself and for many others. He's into private equities, and his name is Hunter Thompson. No, not that Hunter Thompson, but you can find him at cashflowconnections.com. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's an honor to be on. Thanks again for having me.
Likewise. So, looking at your site, kind of getting an idea from your podcast of what you're about, you kind of are very, shall we say, cautious about the economy and wary of the direction we're heading. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm looking at, there's a couple of data points that I find extremely compelling. I mean, most of your listeners are familiar with the fact that, you know, there's 10,000 baby boomers hitting the age of retirement every single day. Most of them have very little savings. A lot of them are relying on Social Security as a source of income. Even in its current state, this is mathematically impossible. The average Social Security check is about $1,300 a month. The average two-bedroom apartment rents for about $1,200 a month. So without even getting into the whole fact that it's basically one of the largest Ponzi schemes in the world and it's completely insolvable, even in its current state, it is not a viable option. And yet it is a big, big part of the economy and something that's going to continue to be a big problem going forward.
Yeah. So basically what you propose is a personal solution to effectively a government problem. Do I have that right?
Yes. I mean, Doug Casey is someone that I think is someone that a lot of people should be listening to, not in terms of necessarily focusing their investments on, but certainly in terms of his perspective on speculating. And this is basically taking the opportunity that governments create all over the world and building investment theses that allow people to prosper. And I think this is one of the major problems in some of the circles of a lot of the doom and gloomers, where, in my opinion, you can take a lot of the same economic data points that they look at and create investment theses which are in vehicles which I think are well positioned to generate really lucrative returns. So, I mean, one of those examples, I think the most obvious one, is mobile home parks. So if you're concerned about the state of the economy, if you think that, you know, we're currently in our 111th month of the expansionary period, second longest in the history of the United States. If you're concerned about that, if you're concerned about the fact that $30,000 a year is not going to get by and more than 50% of the wage earners in the U.S. are making that, if that's concerning to you, you can invest in real estate focused on that tenant base. And if you're thinking that that tenant base is going to continue to grow, you can make an investment based on that. So I'm a huge advocate of taking that same economic data and investing in commercial real estate, where you get all the benefits of investing in real estate, but you're still able to basically short the U.S. economy. And you're getting kind of the best of both worlds there, because if things go well, you're in a position to make money. If the economy starts booming and the capital markets are very loose, you're also in a position to make money. I think you can catch both sides of that spectrum there.
Mm-hmm. So how much do you need to spend on this? What do you need? How much do you need to be investing?
Well, it's interesting. One of the reasons that I'm a big proponent of the passive investment structure is that allows people to pull their capital together and get into high quality deals and depend on sponsors or operating partners, time, energy, and expertise, and also access to capital. So what I do and what we do as a company is we identify those best in class operating partners and create syndications for them to invest in. Now, that might be a term that some of your listeners are familiar with. 10 years ago, that term was not very popular. It was not something that a lot of people did. This is in part due to the fact that there were some pretty significant changes in laws that took place in 2012 and 2013. The Jobs Act allowed syndicators to publicly advertise for accredited investors for specific investments. And this opened up a complete new opportunity for most people that didn't really have this idea that they could invest in properties that were $15, $50 million properties with only, let's say, $30, $50, or sometimes $100,000. And so that is definitely something to consider because of the fact that you're able to leverage other people's expertise. If that wasn't the case, financially, it wouldn't make sense. But more importantly, one of the main challenges with investing in real estate is liability. And even if you know what you're doing, something can go wrong on a property that can put you in a really precarious financial situation. And so the way that these legal documents are written and the investments that we do, there's a distinction, a very important distinction between the operating partner and the passive investors. And that distinction functionally eliminates the liability that passive investors would receive on a on-property basis. So when you're kind of cumulatively looking at this, you're able to receive similar returns, but you're not exposing yourself to the liability. And when it comes to building a portfolio, I think it's absolutely critical because when things go wrong, everyone gets sued, no matter who's at fault.
Yep, that's very true. You know, everybody's going to the courthouse. I'll sue you this, I'll sue you that. So how do you minimize these issues, minimize your risk? Because look, when you get into these deals, you're getting into bed with people you don't know. That's dangerous enough even when you do know them. So you got to be looking to minimize your risk. I think you pretty much implied here.
Absolutely. I mean, I have a background playing poker. That's what I did kind of for my summer job through college. And so what you're really looking at in poker is looking for an opportunity to generate asymmetric returns or put in a disproportional amount of risk to get a favorable gain. And so when you're looking at real estate in a similar way, I think it's absolutely critical because comparing a 15% return to another 15% return may not at all paint a clear picture in terms of what is more favorable. So when it comes to, you know, generating those types of returns, I think the first thing you have to look at, to your point, is the operating partner. There's a lot of questions that you can go through and due diligence processes that you can go through. I have to name drop. Actually, I just recently was an article that I wrote was published in Forbes. Now, if you Google 6 questions passive investors should always ask, you'll get a good understanding of some of those steps. I mean, generally speaking, it comes to, you know, understanding, being educated, but then verifying the claims that they make. And I think that's one of the things that people don't do enough of. So when you're talking about interviewing operating partners, or we call them sponsors.
Yes.
If everyone says, oh, you should just, you know, get their track record. Okay. Well, I always like to take that one or two steps deeper. So, I mean, a perfect example of this is look at their track record in perspective of the economic climate. If they have been around for 10 years, I mean, my little sister could have made a ton of money investing in multifamily real estate in Texas if they started their company in 2010. And so that needs to be taken into consideration. Have they been through a recession? How did their company perform during that recession? One of the other things is any company in the world can claim that they own any property in the world. I can point to a $50 million property and say, those 20,000 units over there, those are mine. And in order to verify that, a very simple thing that you can do is pull a preliminary title report. This will actually give you the specific entity which owns that property. You can cross-reference that entity easily with the other claims that the sponsors made.
Easily, yeah. So you have to go beyond just a track record and really go further than that, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that just taking every step, you know, one step further will actually get to the bottom of that. Asking those extra 2 or 3 questions, and I'm not going to lie, it may be a little uncomfortable the first time you do it, but it's not uncomfortable for them if they know what they're doing because they've had hundreds of investors go through that same process. I mean, we've had hundreds of investors ask us hours and hours and hours of questions. And to be honest with you, that's something that makes me feel better as an investor because as an operator of some of these deals or a syndicator, we are going to be together with our investors for many years to come. We invest in illiquid investments in commercial real estate, where our hold period is typically 7 to 10 years. So if we have an investor that's doesn't understand the investment going in or has some buyer's remorse, that's not just a problem for them. It's a problem for everyone involved in the LLC. And so we want our investors to be as educated as possible. Yes, administratively, that's challenging sometimes, but the goal is to build relationships and to help investors invest in deals that they actually understand. And so that's one of the things that we help facilitate.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Egypt is on the verge, once again, becoming a world-renowned gold producer. The Golden Age is being rediscovered. For millennia, ancient Egyptian kingdoms prospered from unparalleled riches. Pharaohs built their empires and flaunted their abundant wealth that was made possible by the country's resource-rich gold deposits. Despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. Aton Resources is at the center of the modern Egyptian mining world, diligently working both as the only public exploration company in Egypt today and as the advocate for mining reform with the Egyptian government. However, those that arrive early, like Aton, will reap the best rewards. Aton's discovery of the legendary lost mountain of gold at Rudruin and its current aggressive drilling program there could potentially reap those rewards. Aton Resources is focused on its 100% owned Abu Marwat concession in the Arabian Nubian Shield, located 200 kilometers north of Sentimin Sakari's world-class gold mine. Aton possesses first-mover advantage in the underfollowed jurisdiction of Egypt, which is currently undergoing mining reform. To stay on top of Aton's latest drill results and news, go to AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the TSX-V under the ticker AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Right. So if I caught it right, you're into trailer parks now and... what was the other thing? I'm sorry.
Self-storage.
Self-storage units. Okay. So what's the rationale for those?
Yeah. And I think this is something that, recently both have gotten a lot more attention. We were screaming from the rooftops in 2012 about these asset classes, and it took a major paradigm shift before people were interested. And not to say that we played a significant role in that paradigm shift, but the economy and the overall spectrum of available investments out there and the competition in other asset classes has also driven a lot of traffic to those asset classes. I think, the big picture, we're talking about the economy earlier. I think it makes a lot of sense. The worse the economy does, the more demand there is for affordable housing. But something else. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but I'm just going to ask, for managing trailer parks, aren't those high maintenance and dealing with like a sometimes undesirable element?
Absolutely. You have to be very cautious as the types of properties that you invest in. And so I'll give you just a brief outline of some of the things that we look for. So we typically invest in 3-star parks. So if you can think of things on a scale, 5-star being high quality assets in Florida and California, that probably the cash flow isn't going to be that significant. I like to be in tertiary markets, let's say 30 minutes outside of a market like Dallas or so, or 30 minutes outside of a market like Charlotte, where there's some potential for growth, but it's really not a low cap rate environment. And I like to invest in properties that are 80% tenant owned. And this is an absolutely critical distinction in the business. So most types of real estate, one of the main goals is to have the tenants treat the properties like they own it. Well, right. In this asset class, they actually do. So what we do is we own the lot and the tenant owns the home itself. And this has tremendous implications: stability of the tenant base, their ability to produce income, their inability to move frequently because they're called mobile homes, but they're not homes we invest in or the parks we invest in. The homes themselves are worth $15,000 or maybe $20,000. The cost about $5,000 or maybe even $3,000 to move them. So the tenant base just isn't really going to move. And so when you're looking at all that together, those are just really hard to argue with. I will say, though, to our early conversation, anyone that's listening to this podcast right now, they're privy to that information. So it's not proprietary. It's a big picture thesis. And you need an operating partner that understands how to take advantage of that thesis and make a lucrative returns for investors.
What kind of returns can you get off your average trailer park?
Yeah. So, I mean, we aren't going to be interested in something unless it can produce a low to mid teens. And I think that that's achievable in today's climate. Relatively, you know, conservative underwriting, just to give you an idea to how that's possible. We look for properties that are extremely mismanaged, where nearby two bedroom apartments are going to be renting for sometimes two times the rental rate of the trailer or the mobile home park. So if you're in a property that the home rents for $700 a month for lot rent, a nearby two-bedroom apartment, maybe $1,400 a month, sometimes even $2,100 a month. Right. So you can clearly find properties in the industry where they're $100 under market rent because of how much mismanagement there is in the business. So if you have $100 per month, per property, per lot, times 100 lots, I mean, you can literally be creating $1.2, $1.5 million of value by just raising rents a few times. That wouldn't come with an increase in expenses because very likely they're overpaying their manager when we buy the property. So that's the way that those returns are generated. And self-storage is maybe not as obvious in terms of the recession-resistant component, but I think is just as compelling. But generally speaking, you know, looking for high cash flow assets that have the ability to really increase the operational efficiencies as opposed to taking on proportional risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. And the other thing is they aren't making any more of these trailer parks. Really difficult to build a new one from scratch because no neighborhood in their right mind wants one, basically. And therefore, your pool of this investment vehicle is by its very nature limited and scarce.
Absolutely. I mean, again, I think that that is something that's very hard to argue with. Municipalities, cities, different nonprofits, they're basically banning, they're doing two things at the same time. They're banning the creation of new mobile home parks. And they're also making it very, very challenging in certain markets to create affordable housing for a variety of reasons. So you have all of the squeeze taking place in the lower middle class, and they think that they're doing this for the benefit of those people, which is just insane. They do not understand human incentive and supply and demand. But regardless of that, I don't want to sit here and complain about their actions. I'll do that in my spare time. As an investment manager, I want to see that action and realize that's not changing anytime soon and invest in that to take advantage of that from, you know, for my sake and for my investor's sake.
Yeah, it's like when they sold taxi medallions in New York City, and they originally sold for about $15 a piece during the Great Depression. And in their heyday, they went up to $1 million each, and because they weren't making any more, very limited additions to the stock of taxi medallions.
Wow.
So same kind of concept where scarcity, where bad management. Are there like revenue opportunities in these trailer parks to either build more units or other income sources? You know, do we have that there?
See, that's a really important distinction. That's why I think that the conversation about self-storage is also important, and they kind of counteract each other quite well. So with mobile home parks, it's really about in-place income and optimizing that in-place income. You can't really expand the property, and it's relatively straightforward. We don't have all the bells and whistles that you would have in a multifamily even. So you don't have things like pools. You typically don't have things like laundromats and stuff like that, where you can kind of out-optimize your management and really generate revenue like that. And because of that, you're limited in terms of the overall return profile. So it's about generating NOI, generating NUI, decreasing expenses. You can only go so far with that. You can go quite far, but only so far. And so we incorporate self-storage as part of our investment thesis as well. Similarly to mobile home parks, there's a recession-resistant component because people use those products when they're going through transitional periods. Think about job changes or layoffs or people downsizing are very common during recessions, and they also really are to cause demand for the product. So yes, we have those strategies in terms of the demand, but in terms of actually adding value to the property, you can do a lot. One of my favorite examples to give is that we partner with operating partners that have pre-existing relationships with U-Haul or other truck rental companies. Mm-hmm. So we can buy properties based on in-place income, and then the day of, they don't have any relationship with U-Haul. The next day, we call our contact at U-Haul, They park their trucks in our facility, and we rent out those trucks and get a commission for facilitating the transaction.
Sure.
That alone, we talk about asymmetric returns. I have been personally invested in many properties where that one line item has gone from $0 a month to $3,500 or $3,800 a month. So, you know, you're talking about $600,000, $700,000 of equity just by implementing that strategy, not taking on that proportional risk, not developing units, not borrowing additional capital. And I find that, really fascinating, and
that's great.
Definitely favorable.
Hey, for sure. Well, really interesting. I like the idea of recession resistant, because eventually one day, you know, Hunter, we are going to have a recession. It could be the mother of all recessions. It might be a minor one. We don't know yet, but it's coming. That we do know. So people want to find out more about you, I guess they go to cashflowconnections.com. They can find your podcast on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are freely given away.
Yeah, that's correct. And if you guys want to shoot me an email at info@cashflowconnections.com, I'd be happy to shoot you a couple ebooks on self-storage and other stuff that we're working on.
All right. Hey, great. So let's just give that email address again, Hunter, so you can get your free books.
Yeah, it's info@cashflowconnections.com, and my assistant will shoot you over those ebooks. Kind of summarize some of the conversations we had here today. Sure. But generally speaking, education is the most critical part of this entire process. I'm really grateful to be able to be a guest on a program like yours. You just put out so much content, and that's what it's all about right now. You cannot go too hard on content, especially if it's from the right sources. So again, I want to thank you for giving this opportunity and for putting on your show.
Absolutely. Hey, our pleasure, Hunter. Hey, questions, comments, kl@carrielutz.com. Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Hunter, it's been a total pleasure. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks again.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.